This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to a new episode of the New Books Network. My name is Victor Monin, and today I am welcoming Samuel J. Redman, professor of history and director of the public history program at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. So published in 2016, his first book, Bone Rooms, From Scientific Racism to Human Prehistory in Museum, is actually now available in paperback version. So I thought it would be a perfect opportunity to go back on this book and to get a great opportunity to learn more about what bone rooms are and their complex history, but also their complex legacy. So, Professor, thank you so much for joining me today. Could you start by sharing the history or the story, your personal story behind this book? How did you learn about these bone rooms, which, and maybe you could comment on this, but I thought that the title had something ominous in it, as more as descriptive as well. So maybe what kind of trajectory of research led you to these bone rooms, and what did you not expect to find there, and what did you expect to find there?
Sure. So first, thank you for having me, first of all. And my story with this book goes back to my time as a first working as a young person. I started off in the museum world working as an intern behind the scenes working with collections. And major natural history museums have these vast collections of birds and fish and dinosaurs from around the world, and of course amassed major anthropological collections as well. And I was really surprised to learn when I started working in museums that there were these spaces colloquially known as bone rooms that held vast collections of human remains in no small dose of indigenous people from North America, from across North America, but from around the world, indigenous people from around the world and other people from around the world. So I was really surprised to learn of those things. I then went on to graduate school to study U.S. history, but I couldn't stop thinking about these spaces in natural history museums and elsewhere, at medical museums and elsewhere. And so I just kept coming back to that topic. And ultimately, it became the topic of my dissertation and then first book, Bone Rooms.
So when we're talking about vast collection, what are we talking about, really, in terms, if you could give us maybe an idea and scale?
Yes. So I loved thinking about this question, and I also found it much more difficult than you would think. But here's a starting number to sort of get us started. The National Park Service did a survey of all museum collections publicly, you know, available to researchers, and came up with the estimate that there are 500,000 individual sets of Native American remains in U.S. museums. And they estimate that another 500,000 are held by museums in Europe. So that is not including in this tally. And this was one of the major things that I tried to point out in the book Bone Rooms. It's sort of this yes and story. There are also the remains of African Americans and the remains of indigenous people from elsewhere around the world who were brought to these same places, like the Smithsonian, American Museum of Natural History, Field Museum, Berkeley's Museum of Anthropology, and many other places. So these collections often reach into the tens of thousands. The Smithsonian had 35,000 sets of human remains at its peak. When I say vast, I truly mean that in terms of number and size and scale.
So this is also, I mean, I had maybe not, it's quite an interesting, I had a few experiences with the back rooms, if you will, of museums as well. And it turns out that, you know, one thing that a myth that was quickly dispelled for me is the idea that museums know what they have, but they actually don't. There's a lot that they don't know exactly what they have, where it comes from, and it's part of their job to work on it, right? So when we talk about these massive amounts of bones, how much is actually being studied or is actively being processed or used in research?
Right, so it's a mixture in fairness, and I will say that, you know, throughout the course of the 19th and into the 20th century, some scientific research has been done on these collections, and you know we arguably know more about the human body and the history of humanity through these studies. On the other hand, and this is a big but, the visions that were laid out by practitioners of collecting human remains and studying them, of the mysteries of humanity that would be unlocked by these collections and the future research that would be possible, very little of that comes to bear. And, human remains exhibitions, like the use of human remains as a tool in exhibitions, has been quite popular. Ethical problems and concerns and other sorts of fears have meant that a lot of these remains have been mostly behind the scenes and in some cases not really attracting much scientific interest either. So you're seeing a lot of changes in attitudes about these in recent years, I think in part because these institutions are seeing sort of their limited value in a number of different ways. And there's a generational change in terms of the curators who were really committed to keeping some of those collections. But I found less scientific research taking place on these than you might imagine.
So I think what really fascinated me about the book is that it's not just a history book. And I think through history, it actually, to me, it seems like it was also investigating this problematic process through which human individual remains can suddenly become highly coveted scientific specimens, right? And be seen as solely scientific specimen and they're nothing else. And can therefore become objects of contention, in the middle of scientific debates or even competition against institution. So in the beginning of your book, for that, it's really quite powerful because it puts the reader face to face with the moral conundrum of that process, right? You tell the gruesome story of a Dakota man that was shot in 1864, I think, by militiamen in Minnesota, and how first his body was then mutilated before being buried and then unburied to then be passed through multiple scientific hands for different purposes. So we really being put face to face with that process through which these individual remains suddenly lost all sense of individuality and just became that specimen that could be used for different purposes. Could you maybe explain to us what motivated this kind of practice? What made it quote unquote normal at this time, right in the beginning of the second half of 19th century and throughout the beginning of the 20th? What made it normal to just excavate all these human bodies and strip them of their individuality and see them solely as scientific specimens?
That's a really amazing question. And I think about the answer on at least two levels, you know, sort of what the, you know, motivated the curators and the museum directors and the institutions that were setting these collections up. But then also, what motivated the dozens and dozens, if not hundreds and hundreds of other collectors, you know, who were ranging from professional to amateur. So in response to that first part, the sort of the almost the meta motivations, there are, you know, competing theories in Europe and in the United States and North America about race and the human body in this era. And the Civil War looms large in, and you know, scientific racism and justifications for the enslavement of African Americans. There's a really dark history behind a lot of the sort of early justifications for establishing these collections, but a lot of it was about racial difference. And, you know, sort of understanding, quote unquote, from a scientific perspective, these different races from around the world. And as troubled as that was, you know, there was this ongoing conversation about it in different scientific circles that was changing some of these attitudes and ideas. But many people came to the idea that if science is at least in part about replicating measurements and being able to test ideas and theories, the way to test ideas about the human body was, you know, not to focus on when our bodies are alive and covered in flesh and muscle and we can gain and lose water, but the bones are sort of considered more stable. And so this became suddenly this widespread idea that human remains that were bone specifically could be used as a tool for future scientific research. And so that, you know, of course, I see these things as connected. Once the institution started doing things like publishing catalogs for how to collect remains or what remains that they had in their collections, wow, suddenly many people start to collect human remains that had either a passing interest in science or they were sort of early archaeologists or people tangentially connected to the museum. But, you know, pertinent to your last question, too, just really quickly, I'll say that a thing that was totally remarkable to me in looking through the archives for these stories is the vast differences of documentation that came to the museum in connection with these remains. Sometimes it was extremely detailed information about who this person was in life, their name, where they were found when they were deceased, how their body was obtained. And other times it would just be literally, you know, one example of set of remains that I write about in Bone Rooms, someone saying, this is two skulls. One is a Japanese gentleman and one is a Japanese criminal. And that was all of the information that was given, you know, so intensely problematic in how a lot of this is framed, but with limited information too, to try to undo many of these mysteries.
That's to me is fascinating. I find particularly fascinating that last example you mentioned of the gentleman and the criminal, as if these two categories could be referred as natural categories in a way. So, I mean, of course, like it echoes a lot of also the racist tropes that were going on in these research. You touched upon it, but I think, so there's this very difficult process, problematic process of how these human remains become scientific specimens. And you just touched upon the fact that it was not just scientists involved in anthropology or curators involved in those particular bone rooms collection that were themselves collecting, but it was a myriad actually of people who were either in the field for some reason, other scientific reason, or were just curious that were just sent these bones to these museums. So to me, I think it also delved into a very, very, very important question, which is how the rise of this mentality that science is somehow saving things that are out there, right? And I think you talk about salvaging I think that's the second chapter of the book. The idea that if there are human remains somewhere, they're in need of being rescued, and that their final resting place can only be a museum or can only be a place of science. If it's laid down in the ground, then it's just wasted information or wasted data for science. And that would be the worst thing that could happen, right? At least it seems. So I'm very interested in the rise of that mentality, right? Because then we see the impact that it has even today in debates around restitution. But not just for human remains, but also for works of art, et cetera, that were collected in very questionable context, where the remaining strong argument coming from maybe the curatorial side or scientific side is usually, well, we are the only one, or we are in the best position to take care of it. So I see here maybe a link, but maybe you could correct me on this, with the rise of this mentality of salvaging human remains. What do you think are the factors here that contributed to not only the development of that mentality, but also of the spread of this view of science as saving bones, when in fact, I mean, in many contexts, not all, but in many contexts, they were just, it was essentially looting, right? Or desecrating.
Yeah. Yeah, so of course there's a lot to unpack there, and one thing that I'll say right away is that there are a number of contradictions in terms of my answer, my response. So here's an example in terms of answering that, like one of the contradictions. And as a historian and studying history, like you have to get comfortable with contradictions, right? So here's an example. This idea that Native Americans were simultaneously viewed as second-class citizens, not as advanced. There were all of these racist tropes about Native Americans. But also at the turn of the century, a contradiction is clear because they're seen as this valuable resource for North Americans, that they can be written about or their art can be collected and commodified. They set us apart in our culture and our ways from Europeans. In many ways that culture was sort of commodified and desired, as well as being dismissed and hated. These sort of weird contradictions exist in that answer. But I think that this is a process that starts early. I became interested in the Army Medical Museum. And what surprised me is that, very soon after the Civil War, during this era of heated westward expansion and these skirmishes and battles and genocidal acts that are taking place out west, it's really intimately connected with the medical field and with the expansion of empire, that a lot of these medical officers were happy to oblige. That this request came out from the Army to collect human remains for, especially of non-white individuals or battlefield injuries. And I was shocked at how many parcels were arriving in Washington, D.C., and what those things said. And one of the many things that shocked me is how many African-American remains were being sent to the Smithsonian as well. And I didn't see much that had been written about that at the time. But then those remains were transferred to the Smithsonian Institution. And, this, like you said, the museum model really becomes predominant in terms of thinking about how to document and preserve these, but also to sort of publicly communicate those ideas, like the creation of the Hall of Mankind that was the precursor for the San Diego Museum of Man, now the Museum of Us in San Diego. So you can see them all along the way sort of testing out this museum model, both in terms of the research side of things and the public education side of things, that is based on this sort of positivist mindset that there are things out there that can be proven as facts, and we can use the scientific method to sort of do that. And that's applied to human remains using a lot of the ideas at the time. But it's benefiting from the growth of empire and ideas about nationalism, as well as these sort of scientific racist ideas that were predominant at the time.
To me, this idea of the museum being this essentially this arc, right, where everything pertaining to science needs to essentially be stored and saved. We see that the power of it, and I think when you, as you mentioned, when you replace it in a national or empire building context, you better understand why the materiality of all these bones, but other kinds of specimens, were so important, and therefore that led to this argument of salvaging them. Wherever they were, they first were. Reading the book also, and you just mentioned contradiction. So here's one. here's one that is really at the center of your book. It's you talk about, and I'm really quoting here just one of your expression in the book. You talk about a stream of bones that was coming from various places, obviously across the U.S., but also internationally. A stream of bones that was essentially feeding a lot of the major institutions that we know today, right? Like the Smithsonian in D.C., the Field Museum in Chicago, I already mentioned the Field Museum in Chicago, but also the Natural History Museum in New York. So there is that stream of bones, and there is that almost compulsive, systematic collection of bones and sending them off. But what's strange is that although there is this scientific argument to salvage these specimens, once they arrive in the bone room, we're not seeing a straightforward, clear scientific program applied to them, but rather, and I think your book navigates this maze of interpretation, right, that goes on between the mid 19th century up to the mid 20th century and even up to today, which includes, right, these interpretations include scientific racism, they include medicine, they include human prehistory. How did you make sense of that contrast between this active collecting and on the other end, a very ambiguous process of curation and interpretation?
I love that expression that you used of maze of interpretation, because it's very much the case that it is true. And, one of the things that came out in the story is both episodes of institutional and interpersonal cooperation, and then just as often competition, where egos and interpersonal relationships would get in the way and would make things messy and competitive. And, you know, anyone who's studied the history of science deeply knows that this happens in basically every field, right? In physics and microbiology, like there are human beings behind that. And, you know, their lives sometimes get involved. But it really does become these sort of streams of bones, maybe I could have said, because the people that are sending or submitting the bones in have different ideas and interpretations themselves of how these remains will be used, not always lining up with the ideas or desires of the institutions. And then remains are traded, they're swapped, and they're sold on the market occasionally. There are many different ways in which they are sort of entering in to the national collection. So that helps us answer the question of how so many remains. Alisher Dlitchka, who was probably the most, I don't know if you could use the word success here in this, but the most successful bone collector of the 20th century, in that he establishes these massive collections and sort of becomes a leader and early on in the field, and then has this fall from grace that's pretty remarkable as his ideas go out of fashion. But he says shortly after taking the job of a curator at the Smithsonian Institution, already by like the 1910s, that they have 8,000 sets of human remains at the Smithsonian. So that's basically before you get to the systematic collecting that starts taking place, like just sort of the piecemeal independent collecting that's taking place in these early days, results in thousands and thousands of remains being sent to the museum. And indeed, many people sort of perceive them as being these rare assets, you know, like I collected this, some people will say in their letters, because no one was making any use of it, suggesting that remains shouldn't just be left alone, that they, you know, were somehow these scientific resources.
That's very interesting, right? This idea that if a bone lays in the ground or in a grave, it's essentially a wasted bone. I think it connects once again to this idea of salvaging. But if I may quote another expression that really struck me, I actually noted it in my notebook, because I was like, this is such an interesting way to phrase it. And I think it collapses a lot of the theme in your book. You use the expression of bone empires. And I think it's in reference mainly to, these big institutions that are at the center of your book, like the Smithsonian Field Museum. But I think it collapses a lot of other themes in your book as well. Could you maybe comment on that? What motivated that the coining of that expression of bone empires?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So I saw these, as you say, these major institutions, and we've named a number of them, but we could include in the mix the University of Pennsylvania, Harvard University, Yale, as well as smaller institutions like Howard University and medical museums. The Mutter Museum of Philadelphia is a chapter in this book. So it is remarkable how quickly, when those institutions and quote unquote men or women of science in some instances are competing for these resources, both against each other and then also against looters in a very real sense, who are going across the American West, especially, but also places throughout South America and elsewhere around the world, and digging up graves, often for grave goods rather than human remains. But over time, there does become a market for human remains. Franz Boas talks about selling skulls for $4 or $5 for a skull. There is sort of this sense of competition. And of course, the establishing of these major museums and their support over many generations is in no small part about urban boosterism, you know, about Chicago, deserving this great natural history museum, or New York deserving this great natural history museum to compete with London. So it's as much a city versus city sort of urban boosterism as it is also a story of nationalism. But you sort of put all of that together and you have these sort of imperial acts of growth and acquisition and collecting that are sort of reminiscent of empires in other ways. And of course, you know, we are also talking about mummies and brains and other pieces of flesh. But by and large, when you enter these spaces, they're row after row after row of human bones. So bone empires came to me as an expression to sort of express what it is we're seeing here.
I'm glad you mentioned the mummies, the brains. I think some also flesh. That was collected. I think to me also what was interesting about the book is that there is this traditional way of seeing the history of museums as their first avatar being the Cabinet of Curiosities, right? And then you would through process of more systematization and professionalization lead to the modern museum that we know today. But I think in the case of bone rooms, for example, this is where that very linear narrative kind of becomes more problematic because the bone rooms in times, in the way you describe them or the way they're being used for exhibitions, for example, or the way scientists or curators are trying to get more funding for it or get their research more get more support for their research. We are going back to bones, not just as scientific specimens or as they're being advertised in order to be collected, but as curios. And I think, you know, there's not just that we talked about the problematic process of getting these individual remains into scientific specimen, but then there's this weird moment where they're both scientific specimens and get back to being curios. Could you maybe comment on that? Explain like what happens once they're being quote unquote salvaged?
Sure. So, when the remains would arrive at an institution, quite commonly they'd be unpacked and examined and processed in a way that was quite similar to other types of material. And one of the stories in the book, but also a story for anthropology and the science of anatomy more generally, are debates in the early 20th century, especially about how exactly to consistently measure the human body, like what measurements, because, you know, the skull is sort of a weirdly shaped ball that is inconsistent, and you know how to measure from one location to another. There's a surprising lack of consistency over many, many decades and decades, I would say, before that is sort of systematized and sorted out. The Smithsonian has a lot to do with that, in that they're processing and cataloging these collections and then maybe trading them away from one place to another. But it is also simultaneously the case, as they're working to sort of normalize and make into specimens, sort of to scientize these collections, there are also these spectacular or remarkable collections that arrive at museums as well, that, you know, sometimes are very ancient or were acquired from sort of bizarre circumstances. For example, Magdalenian girl at the Field Museum, which is one of the oldest European quote unquote specimens of, you know, any skeleton of a European human sent to North America. And according to some sources, she was sent to North America in an American flag draped coffin, convincing inspection officials that this was the remains of a fallen soldier. And so they didn't really do much careful checking. So this national treasure of France leaves and comes to a museum in the United States. There's this prevailing idea that these are resources that are best served through their processing and taking part in this scientific conversation. And don't get me wrong, there are some studies that are done and redone in terms of studying questions about race and human history. But there's always been ethical questions and concerns around those. And they're still publishing new articles in journals about asking questions like, how do we, they're more vocally and more thoroughly upfront, do thinking and talking about the ethical problems related to these collections, as well as doing legitimate scientific research on them.
Switch now to maybe another topic. I think there's an absence in the book, but a telling absence, and I'm sure you can comment on it. It's the voices of Native American, for example, and their relation at the time to that process. I'm saying it's a telling absence in the sense that I think it because it's linked to a lot of difficulties in terms of like getting the archives, getting the stories, and also the power relation that allowed for this systematic collecting in the first place. So maybe can you comment on maybe the difficulties maybe of getting that story, right? Getting this other side of the story, and how it shapes maybe some of the debates today around restitutions.
Totally. So the focus of this book, I should say, I maybe should have said up front, the focus of this book is roughly the time period 1865 to 1945, or the Civil War to World War II, more or less. And during that time, you see a whole host of ways in which Native voices or resistance to this process was erased. Now, there are interesting counterexamples. For instance, letters of people saying that they were robbing a particular grave and then they were attacked by local Native people. So we know from many different ways that there was a resistance to much of this practice. And now we also need to respect, right, that there are more than 400 different Native nations, communities in North America, and they all have different, slightly, different attitudes about death and burial. And so it's not, just one sort of unified thing, but by and large, many Native people were not supporting of this as a process, but there wasn't the systematic, to your point about power differential, there wasn't a lot of ability to sort of stage or mount a systematic resistance to this. But by the 1960s and 1970s, you start to see things in the archives, like episodes of Native protests and resistance in relationship to these stories about collecting, sacred objects in addition to human remains. And then by the 1980s and 1990s, this is really swelled into a firestorm that ultimately results in the passage of the National Museum of the American Indian Act and NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act in 1990, that finally gives Native people a mechanism for calling for these remains back today. But yeah, I would say, that's been one of the critiques of the book. It's a history book that looks back at this earlier era. It seemed to me like there was some that had been written about the origins of these stories and some that had been written about the contemporary sort of ethics of these. But I was surprised that the sort of era of great and massive collecting, sort of what really created these problems. Sure, the origins do as well, but when you look at 30,000 sets of human remains, like that was my core question: like how did these get here? And yeah, frankly, that involves a lot of erasure of native voice in the process that now we need to look to, frankly, native people and for advice on how to move forward and to rectify the situation and repatriation in many cases. But this intended to be a book to try to add to that conversation in that one way.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, I don't see it as a critique really to the book. To me, it was just, I think it illustrates, just as you mentioned, the fact that at the same time that bones were quote unquote salvaged, once again, another paradox of history is that you can at the same time collect and curate certain aspects of a period or the past, while at the same time systematically erasing another, and usually they go hand in hand in the sense of the process of erasure is helping the process of or sustaining the process of collecting whatever you want to collect. So I think to me that was very, very interesting to look at the book also and having this constant echo of, all right, the debates now around how should they measure these skulls, et cetera. What is the voice that's missing? And I think your book, especially at the beginning, right, with the story of the Dakota men, and at the end where you you mentioned the possibility of seeing these bones more as individuals rather than just as specimens, is doing a good job as reminding us of that missing voice. Maybe the last question I'd like to ask you is, where has your research on bone rooms led you so far, right? I mean, this book was first published, as I mentioned, in 2016. You know, you've as you mentioned, discovered that this history from the mid-19th century up to the mid-20th century hadn't been really, you know, systematically studied. So where has this, you know, discovery led you to so far?
Yeah, it's been a really remarkable journey. And, you know, when a book comes out, of course, there's sort of this conversation about it potentially if you're lucky. But then that, you know, of course, goes away in terms of course, many academic books and things of that nature. But then in the last couple of years, a real wave of stories related to these issues has come to the fore again. And I'm simultaneously surprised and not surprised by that because, you know, sort of the whole point of this story is that there remains a huge number of stories that are little known and under told. And they relate in many cases to the brutal exploitation of remains through these racist frameworks that allowed major scientific institutions to benefit over the course of many, many years. It's a real shocking history and shocking story. So a couple of years ago when Harvard announced that it may have the remains of some enslaved, formerly enslaved individuals in its collection, that created a wave of attention that, you know, sort of domino effect led to people looking with more introspection at the University of Pennsylvania collection and the Smithsonian and elsewhere. This coincided with the growth and reemergence of Black Lives Matter protests and broader conversations about systematic racism. An episode around the MOVE bombing victims and their use of their remains in an anthropology class at the University of Pennsylvania again brought about a great deal of attention to the stories. But this is going to continue, frankly. This sort of discovery and need to sort of wrestle with these collections, it's not going away. So the Smithsonian has worked on revising many of its policies, and University of Pennsylvania and Harvard have made statements. So I feel fortunate that my book has played a small part, I think, in helping move this conversation along. And it's being released now in paperback, I think, because of the added attention to these stories. And I think that's ultimately a good thing that we're having these conversations.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. I really, once again, that was an absolute pleasure to delve into that book. And I think, you know, through the very, very difficult questions of how do these massive collections of human remains came about, the process of seeing them as scientific specimens. And now I think what seems to be not necessarily a reversed process, but kind of a complementary or an answering process of seeing them as under more complex lights, and also seeing that it requires a variety of actors to really treat them in a way that is both, that could be both scientific, but also respectful. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for this interview. That was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me.